Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me today Ben Mossman. He is the president and CEO of Rise Gold Corp. I invited Ben on the show today to talk about Rise Gold Corp because I believe it is a very undervalued company that is moving what was once the second most prolific gold mine in America back into production. I'm talking about the Idaho-Maryland mine in Nevada County, California, and it was second only to the Great Homestake mine until it was closed down in World War II. Ben is a very experienced mining engineer who has been very successful in the past with companies like De Beers Canada and Alexco Resources Corp. And so Ben's skills are geared not to mining exploration so much as to actually putting mines into production. And that is totally appropriate given the fact that the main asset that Rise has is the Idaho-Nevada gold mine located at Grass Valley, California. It's already has a very significant high-grade gold deposit that is probably at least as large as all the gold that was mined so far, a couple of million ounces of high-grade gold. And in my view, based on what I know, this is potentially a very profitable gold mining project that is being moved as we speak towards production. Rise is currently selling at around 60 cents in U.S. money. It has only 22 million shares outstanding. This is a minuscule market cap of a little over $13 million. Of the 22 million shares outstanding, fewer than half of that number are in the public float, meaning that it may be very difficult to pick up shares once this story starts to be heard and understood and believed by mining investors. Believing very much that this company's prospects are very good, I purchased shares personally on the market and have recommended the shares to my subscribers to J. Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. So I'm very pleased to have Ben Mossman with me. Thanks for joining me today, Ben.
Thanks a lot, Jay.
It's really good to have you. You know, I would like to start out by asking you to give us a brief history of the Idaho-Maryland mine. As I noted, it was in production until World War II. It was one of the more significant, if not perhaps the second most significant gold mine in the United States up until that time. When was hard rock gold discovered there? And you know, how much was produced, and give us some idea of the grades that were produced there?
Sure. This area here in Nevada County was one of the first areas where the gold rush started in 1849. So the 49ers came out, they started with the placer gold, and then in 1851 they found the outcrop of the ore body, which was called Eureka at the time. And so they kind of started to realize, you know, that the gold was in the quartz as well. And so 1851 they found it. Spent a few years, you know, trying to figure out how to get the gold out of it, and so by 1863, they sunk a shaft down into the vein, and they found the main chute of the ore, and was grading 1.3 ounces per ton, so very high grade. And then that kind of catapulted the company back then into becoming the leading gold producer in the United States, you know, way back in 1865. And at one time, it was the deepest mine in the entire United States. So that vein that they discovered, which is now called the One Vein, produced almost a million ounces of gold at over an ounce per ton from one single vein. So just one vein, they mined it until about 1900. The owners at the time were the Coleman brothers, which were quite famous in California, especially in that era. So it became very wealthy, and then the vein, you know, went off to the next claim, which was the Maryland claim. And so it went from the Eureka claim to the Idaho claim to the Maryland claim, and that's why it's called the Idaho-Maryland mine. So as it went on to the next person's claim, they would take over the mining. And so they finished the mining of that number one vein in about 1900, and then it sat idle for a few years. In the 20s, a group from New York financed the dewatering of the mine. So they pumped all the water out. They started looking around for more ore, and they were within, you know, a couple feet of finding the next vein over, which is, you know, just a little offset of the one vein, which is called the three vein. And so that group gave up, and an engineer called Aaron McBoyle, who was involved in the project and put the whole deal together, you know, took over the project, and then right away, you know, within a year, cross-cut right into the three vein, which is extremely high grade. It produced over 600,000 on its own, and some of the ore coming out there, you know, was 3 ounces per ton. And so that vein averaged about 20 grams per ton over its history, and then quickly kind of built up the mine. They built the production. They were up, you know, past 1,000 tons per day in about 1940, producing over 120,000 ounces of gold a year. The second biggest low gold mine in the entire United States, second only to the Homestake mine, which of course is a huge deposit that was mined at that time and then mined for a long time after. And so was eventually by the 42, they were going through a big expansion phase. So they're already over 120,000 ounces gold a year. They wanted to double the production to go from 1,000 tons a day to 2,000 tons per day. And they put a brand new headframe up. They were sinking a shaft as fast as they could. They got down to 3,200 feet before it was shut down, and they were trying to get it down to 5,000 feet. So not only was it, you know, a major mine, but they were also, you know, at the very stage where they were going to double the production from there. And so the total production from the history of the mine is 2.4 million ounces of gold at an average head grade of 0.5 ounce per ton. So,
wow.
So that's after mine dilution. That's what was actually fed into the mill. So extremely high grade. And of that 2.4 million ounces, the one vein itself produced 935,000 ounces at 1.1 ounces per ton. So,
wow. Incredibly rich. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so was the mine, let's say back in 1940 when they reached 120,000 ounces, was it a pretty profitable endeavor? I mean, at that time, I guess the gold price was what?
Before 1934, it was about $20 an ounce. In 1934, they increased the price of $35 an ounce. So it was making money at $20 an ounce. But when they raised the price of gold, $35, of course, it was making, you know, a lot more. And during the last 5 years of its production, it was producing at $6 per ton and $18 an ounce. So they're selling for $35 and producing at $18.
Okay.
And the main shareholder, Aaron McBoyle, who had something around half the company stock, you know, became extremely wealthy from the mine. He had, you know, racehorses and orchards and you know, private planes and all those things. So it had, it was very profitable. They paid back all of their, they had all the preferred shareholders. They paid back who financed the capital to put the mine back into production, and then of course paid dividends to their common shareholders. But I think it's, you look through the history, anyone who had invested the mine from, you know, the early 1800s all the way to the end, except for this one group from New York who kind of gave up, you know, one round short of the ore body, they all made a profit on their investment. So
it's been a very profitable endeavor, Ben. And so you mentioned they were going to continue mining to depth and actually double the production. What do you know now about the extent of the gold mineralization at depth from where they the old workings?
When we first purchased the property in 2017, the family that owned the property had all the historic documents, and they kept all of them in very good condition. So thousands of maps, you know, documents of where they were mining, notes, reports. So we had a good idea that, you know, they had just kind of just they'd been forced to shut down by the government. They could just drop the tools and left. And there's places there that you know, they have channel samples in the tunnel where they're mining when they stopped that, you know, were over 10 ounces per ton, you know. So we had a good idea that there's a lot of ore left there. And their plan to sink the shaft down to 5,000 feet, of course, that, you know, they weren't able to really do core drilling like we're able to do now. They could drill horizontal holes a couple hundred feet. So they weren't able to drill down deep to see how far it goes. But based on their, you know, on the geology, they expected that it would. So that's why they were sinking the shaft to 5,000 feet. And so when we started drilling on the property, we drilled about 18 holes, but deep holes, wide the space to basically see like how far these veins continue to depth. And we had, you know, some really excellent results. The deepest hole we had was, you know, over 1,000 meters below the where they had stopped mining. And we hit there 24 grams per ton over 4.5 meters. So that was the deepest hole. And then we've had, you know, hits as high as 64 ounces per ton over a foot and a half, 13 ounces per ton over, you know, 3 feet, ounce over 3.5 feet. So basically, you know, almost everywhere you drill, and we've drilled over, you know, probably a square mile of area through these widely spaced holes, we've hit, you know, high grade gold, which is very favorable to the idea that these veins will continue a long ways down.
The big issue that I hear whenever I tell people your story, Ben, is that it's in California and you can't get permitted. You can't mine. The Californian people, environmentally sensitive people, are not interested in seeing a gold mine being built there. You can take a few minutes perhaps to let our listeners know why you think they're wrong.
Yeah, and so this obviously is a big question for investors, and it kind of starts, you know, back in the 90s when you know, gold, there's a lot of gold in California, and so at that time, you know, they had just kind of figured out how to do open pit heap leach mining, and so a lot of companies came to California and built open pit heap leach mines beside, you know, all these little towns mm-hmm. in the Northern Sierra, which obviously it doesn't make them too popular. And so there was a big pushback from California State on open pit heap leach mines, and forced a lot of mining companies out, and a lot of companies just left and never came back. But what we're talking about here is an underground mine, so it's a lot less environmental impact. And then in this case, because all the mine, the land was patented, you know, back in the gold rush days, it's all private land. And so because it's private land in California, the land decisions are made by on the county level. And so the property is located in Nevada County, California, and the permit that we're applying for is a use permit to reopen the mine. And the discretionary power is with the county, and so that's a big point. Mm-hmm. So you have to deal with some state agencies for some secondary permits, mm-hmm. but all the discretionary power is with the county. And so you have to go through the California Environmental Quality Act, which kind of lays out what has to be studied. But if you look through all these issues, which we've prepared all these technical reports and then done our designs on, there's very few impacts. You know, there's no significant impact from noise, you know, dust. Working on the groundwater, we don't think that that's going to be an issue as far as the drawdown of the groundwater table. Mm-hmm. We're doing water treatment so that the water that's coming out, that's being discharged from the mine, that you're pumping out the mine, is clean to drinking water, are better than drinking water quality. So there's very few impacts, and that's going to really start coming out in the next short while, where people are going to see through these technical reports that, you know, this is going to be just a wonderful project for this area that has no impacts. Basically, you can't hear it, you're not going to be able to see it, and the water's, you know, perfectly clean, and there's a number of things like that. So we've looked at this for a long time and spent a lot of time thinking about how it should be designed and built. And so we think that the political environment here is also very favorable to getting it permitted. And so that's going to come out over time. And I think once people see that process in action with this permit, that they're gonna have a different view for me.
Well, Ben, how much time? I mean, that's always the question. What I know it's impossible to predict exactly when government people will act and will give you the permission. But can you give our listeners some sense of timing on this?
We've submitted the application for the use permit, and this is the main discretionary permit. And so that permit was submitted in November, a couple months ago. And then what right now the county is hiring a third-party consultant. And so this is kind of one of the advantages over other jurisdictions, is that the county, it hires the consultant to write the environmental assessment report, and then RISE pays for the cost. So the consultant works for the county to write the draft report, and basically they take all the reports that our consultants have written on all these different areas, and then they peer review them, and then they write the impact report to go through this big list of questions to say, okay, what's the impact? And then if there is an impact, what's the mitigation? And so that hiring process we expect will be completed in March. And then as soon as they're hired, they'll start working on writing the draft EIR, which could take about 4 or 5 months. Once that's written, then it goes to the public comment period. And so that's where you're going to really start seeing it more in the public realm. And so there's a 45-day comment period where basically people in the county, other government agencies can comment on the project. And so once you have all these comments in, the consultant, he takes those comments and he has to answer every single one of them. And so comments to be like, well, I just don't like gold mining, those comments are really easy to answer because that's not due with the environmental effects of the project. So it's comments that, you know, are technical in nature that that take the most time to answer. And those are the questions that are important. And so once those comments are answered, it goes to the final environmental impact report. And then that goes to the county planning commission. And then the county supervisors. The county supervisors are 5 elected officials in the county, and they have the final vote on whether it's approved or not.
All right. So do you think maybe as we get towards the end of the year, the public might start to see this is a very environmentally friendly project?
Yeah, and that's really where it comes out, because there's a lot of technical information already out in the public domain, but you know it's a lot to read through and understand. And so the summary of it in this environmental assessment, you know, basically answers questions that people are, you know, worried about. Well, what about greenhouse gases? You know, the answer's in there. You know, it's not significant, and all those different areas. And so you know, there's always a few people that are, you know, against growth and things like that. But But overall, like having been here, I've lived here for over a year and a half, the great majority of people that you meet are favorable to the project. And that's before even really understanding, you know, the impacts of the projects, which we believe are very, very few impacts. So I think you're going to see a lot of local support as this thing moves through the process. And then, you know, that'll be a stage where investors, you know, who aren't here, we'll have a better idea of the probability of success and also the timing of success. So it's a bit up in the air exactly when it would get approved. You know, we've said basically 12 to 18 months from November. So you could be looking at, you know, in a good case, the end of this year. If it's going to take a bit longer, you're looking, say, like 1 year from today. That's our goal.
Okay, Ben, let me ask you with regard to the economics. You indicated a bit ago that it was costing $6 a ton, $35 on the top end. So that left a pretty strong margin. I want to ask you if you expect to do any economic studies anytime soon, a PEA at least, or even a bankable feasibility study, if you might do that. And I know it's a forward-looking statement, but do you have a sense of whether or not those same kind of margins, better or worse, might be possible going forward? Because those are very, very strong margins. Obviously, if you had the same margins today with the, you know, $1,600 gold, you'd be looking at something over $1,000 an ounce, maybe.
Yeah. So, yeah, the interesting thing about the historic numbers and inflation is that, like, if you take the standard kind of inflation numbers, and you probably know more about this than I do, but if you take that, you know, that $6 a ton and times it by 18, you end up with about $110 a ton, and so. $110 a ton is kind of, it's in the range of what you would expect based on other operations, production rates. So the, you know, a mine around 1,000 tons per day, you look at some comparables, you know, they would be producing from about $100 to up to $230 per ton. And that's same range, same type of ore body, same grade. And so the cost per ounce, of course, depends, a lot on the grade of the, sure. of the deposit. So if you're looking at, say, the $100 to $250 per ton range, you know, you'd have to kind of do your own calculations and your own speculations on what the actual mine grade is. But,
yeah.
But you know, we're looking at a higher grade mine. That's what our goal is to, you know, we're looking at this as a higher grade mine. Of course, the average production would happen per ton. We've had quite a few good drill results. But there's not enough drilling there to calculate a resource. So we don't have a resource, so we can't, you know, say what the grade is going to be. So it takes a bit of speculation to consider that, but that's kind of the range you're looking at, you know, $100, $250 per ton, and then if you use just straight inflation on the old cost, it'd mm-hmm. be about $110. And the interesting thing about that inflation is that if you use that same inflation number on the price of gold from $35, yeah. it would be $600 an ounce, and of course now it's trading something like $1,600.
Exactly. Yeah. So you would think the margins, just back of the envelope here, it looks like the margins could be quite good. And you said the average grades were half an ounce a ton. I'm wondering, Ben, to what extent you might pick up some lower grade material now with higher gold prices. Although I suppose you don't know that at this point in time.
We've put out a number of different news releases about drill results. And so there are areas there where there's, you know, three veins close together. And then the material in between is also has gold in it, you know, a couple of grams per ton, which most likely be worthwhile taking the entire block, you know, all three veins to be mined at once and still
sure.
come out with a very, very good grade. And so when we started drilling, you know, we didn't know that if we could actually hit this really high grade material that they had, you know, talked about mining in the past. But,
mm-hmm.
but surprisingly, you know, we did. We hit quite a few holes with visible gold, and of course, you know, the highest one was at 64 ounces per ton. But so it's quite incredible, really, that you can hit something like that from such a far distance on surface. So
yeah.
So there's a lot of potential. I think once you won't really know the true answer to that until you get underground and
mm-hmm.
start mining in some of these different veins. But you are going to find, you know, these areas where you have this extremely high grade, and it could be that, you know, you blend that in with some lower grade, you mm-hmm. mine some of the lower grade as water width, and so a lot of those kind of questions as far as grade is, or what you would mine, or what
yeah.
economic, or what is the best strategy to mine, won't be known until
you get underground. All right, Ben. So I'm wondering, will you be doing any formal economic studies anytime soon, or might you just get down there and start mining and then continue to mine going forward as you go, and as you do the work down underneath the ground, you can start to understand better the prospects.
Yeah, it could be done either way, and we haven't decided which way is best, and we probably won't know that until we get further into this permitting process, and a lot of it depends on the market as well. And so you basically have two strategies, two basic strategies. You know, one is that you get the permit, and then you drill out, drill more holes from surface to prepare a resource. And then when you have to have that resource in place, then you prepare, you know, either a PEA study or a feasibility study, depending on the level or the detail of the drilling. And so that's the conventional way to do it. And that can be done. We've had a lot of success from our drilling from surface, so we feel confident that it could be drilled from surface. And the other way is that, you know, once you get that use permit in place, you kind of immediately go and start dewatering the mine. And so you got to pump all the water out of the mine, which would take about 6 months to get all that water out. You know, you get back underground, and then, of course, now you're drilling right beside the vein, so the drilling, the drill holes are a lot shorter. You can actually, you know, go and touch the veins because they're right in the existing tunnel. So you get more work done for your money, and of course you're that much closer to production because, you know, the mine is already dewatered and you're down there. So there's advantages to each, and that'll kind of depend on where we're at once this permit gets in place. And basically our strategy right now is, because we think that, you know, the company is very undervalued, we think that by getting this permit, that's going to result in a major, you know, re-rating the value of the stock, because that seems to be the most concern. We don't often hear people questioning, you know, the quality of the property from a gold point of view. People's most concerns is to do with, can it be permitted?
Right, so exactly.
That's the first thing to resolve. And then after that, you know, there's a few different ways to advance property that we haven't really committed to either at this point.
Ben, just with a couple of minutes left here yet, recently I was talking to a major shareholder of Rise, and he noted that prior to the 1970, for example, in the 1940s, 90% of the cash flow for the Idaho Maryland mines was paid out to the shareholders. But I'm wondering, you know, and there was some thought that possibly, given the legal structure in the United States for resource projects, that a master limited partnership might be a possibility, whereby a large percentage of the cash flow is actually paid out to the owners of the company. Of course, in that way, allowing to avoid the double taxation that is the bane of American corporations to a great extent. But is there some thought that might be a route that the company takes in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at it into a few different advantages of different structures. And so one of the unique things about Rise is that it's a U.S. company, and so, which is unusual, because, you know, most companies, they start out as Canadian companies, of course. And so Rise is a U.S. company, and it's a, you know, SEC reporting issuer, which opens up a few different avenues. And so, you have the master limited partnership, which we're looking into. And then there's also another, kind of new tax benefit that's being set up called an opportunity zone. And so they've laid out different areas of, you know, where I have higher unemployment, higher poverty, and the mine actually fits more of these opportunity zones, which there's some tax benefits to that, which requires some structuring to make it work, but that's something we're looking to as well. And the main thing is that, you know, Rise is focusing 100% on the Idaho, Maryland. We have no plans to, you know, acquire some property up in Manitoba or something. You know, this is our focus. I think a lot of investors, you know, are quite, you know, tired of, you know, they have success on a project, and then the company, you know, goes and buys, you know, some other projects, so that the money is always invested to growth rather than being paid back to the investors. And so that's our model, and that's what we want this to become. And so the structure of that, you know, something that has to be thought about over time. But I think that by the time we get to these permits, we should have a pretty good idea of
what's
the most favorable structure for the investors.
Wonderful. Well, just one more thing. We're just about out of time here, Ben. But I've mentioned that you have only 22 million shares outstanding. Can you give us an idea of how many of those shares might be in the float? Because it's my belief that this is a very tight share structure, obviously, with just 22 million shares. But if a large percentage of those are even owned by a handful of people, then that means there's not a lot of stock out there for people to buy.
Yeah. So the largest two shareholders, which is Yamana Gold and Southern Arc, they own 25% of the stock. And so we don't expect that they would sell it anytime soon. Of course, they're able to sell whenever they want, but they've invested for strategic reasons. You know, Yamana's a bit different than Southern Arc. Yamana's, of course, interested in gold projects because they're a large gold producing company. And then Southern Arc is more like a typical investor looking for a return on their investment and their holdings. And then so 25% is with those two shareholders. And then we have quite a few shareholders that we have, you know, strong relationships with that we would talk to, you know, once a week or something. So I would think that was probably over another 25%. So you might have, you know, somewhat less than half the stock, you know, kind of in available for trading or that people might trade. So it has traded pretty good. It does have, you know, pretty good volumes for a small company. The price isn't that high, but it does have, you know, decent liquidity for the size of the company. And
so it's possible at this stage to buy stock. And I think, though, that my view is that when people start to realize that this is a real project, a real mine, a very potentially very robust economic story, that people are likely to get much more interested in it than they have been at this time when they're still sort of figuring, nothing's going to happen there. It's in California, so.
It's been a bit quiet lately. You know, it's because, you know, it's a bit boring to file tech reports.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's I don't think it's just going to wait until the final approval. I think as these things progress, I mean, there is going to be news flow as far as, you know, the results of these technical reports, the you know, public comment periods, and as things kind of move through the process, I think people will, you know, the people that spend the time to actually, you know, watch it and read through these different reports and come to their own conclusions on the probability of success and the timing, I think you'll start seeing you know, more people you know, buying the stock. And the other thing is that we have raised a fair bit of money this summer, so we have all the funds in place so that we don't have to finance until that permit is completed. So we won't be issuing stock from the treasury. So if investors want to buy a position in the company, they would buy on the market.
All right. Well, very good, Ben. This is a very exciting story, but I see the potential here of something that I think could be very significant for investors who recognize what you're doing there. Ben, I want to thank you so much for the time that you've spent with us, and we'll look forward to keeping up with the story as this year progresses. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jay.